From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made every hour of the day in just about every setting imaginable. On the road, in a home office, lying in bed, in the shower. Comedians are trying to create new material, and it's a particularly difficult challenge right now because many comedians have given up on using politics as a basis for laughs. The writer Owen Ellickson recently tweeted that the current reality is too painful and too grave for comedy. And so that had us wondering, can comedians be kind and still find success? Do they have to be cutting? Well, there's one comedian in particular who rises to the top, in my view, and I have wanted to get him on this show for a long time. Today, it's finally happening. That comedian is Mike Birbiglia. He was like a lot of working comedians for years, doing stand-up, taking the best gigs he could get, and then he broke through thanks to Ira Glass and This American Life. By now, if you are a regular listener of This American Life, you've heard Birbiglia many times. Here's an example that captures his comedic style. He's a storyteller with heart. In this clip, he's describing the night that he was T-boned in a drunk driving accident. He wasn't drunk. The other driver was.
1.5 seconds, I'm spun around. I think I'm dead. No way, I'm paralyzed. And then I hear nothing. Then I hear the other car skid out and drive away. 20 minutes later, I'm sitting on the curb. At this point, the police have arrived, as well as my friend Andy, and that's when I start crying. You know how when you drop a baby on the ground, it doesn't start crying right away because it doesn't understand the concept of dropping a baby on the ground until it sees your face. And then it's like, oh, I guess I should be doing something that matches that. Because I'm looking at my totaled car in front of me and realizing that in that moment I might have ceased to exist. Like I said earlier, I don't really believe in anything, so in my mind that would have been the end of all things I'd experienced in my life. Every kiss or failed kiss or scrambler ride would have come to a conclusion. And the officer comes over and he says, "What happened?" And I said, "I got hit by this car, and then I heard nothing, and I heard the other car skid out and drive away." The officer points over to the light. The other car has made a right turn at the light and veered into this very skinny tree. I can't help but think, that's karma. That's a hit and run and hit.
That's a taste of Mike Birbiglia, who's coming to Rochester this Friday and Saturday night at the new club, Comedy at the Carlson. This hour, we're talking about the soul of comedy, particularly in the age of Trump. Mike tweets about Trump, but his comedy is about life. So, Mike, I just want to thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I feel good. I'm excited to come to Rochester. Actually, our improv coach, Liz Allen, told me all about your show when she was from Don't Think Twice, my movie Don't Think Twice.
Yeah. We'll take any... hold on, let me back up. Did she warn you not to do it? Is that why you're telling me this?
No. She said that she told me all about... We have a lot of similarities. Interest in improv. You have a sleepwalking issue.
Yes.
There's a lot of crossover.
Let me back out. So we'll work through a little history here. We're talking to Mike Birbiglia, who is coming July 14th and 15th at Comedy at the Carlson. That's a relatively new club. It's off Blossom. Tickets are still available, and we'll make sure our listeners are linked up if they want to get the tickets. Take me back a little bit, Mike, because I think it's fair to say that NPR, or really This American Life and Ira, have meant a lot to you. How did you make that connection in the first place?
This American Life was a show that I'd wanted to tell stories on for many, many years. I mean, I feel like I'd heard pieces by David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell and David Rakoff for many years, and I always thought, like, oh, that would be a great fit for me if I could get in touch with those folks. It's a bit of a fortress in terms of there's a lot of people who want to tell stories on the show or feel that way. And so they're, I think, inundated with submissions. And I asked Catherine Burns, who is the artistic director of The Moth, to submit if she would send over my sleepwalking story, which is it later became a one-person show and a movie. And she did, and they took to it, and that was sort of my introduction to the show.
Yeah, you mentioned David Rakoff. I mean, for me, the late David Rakoff is, I think he's the best writer of our generation.
Oh, wow.
Every time I read his essays, I would think, I better be writing down words that I don't know here. But he did it effortlessly. He was funny. I thought he was a great storyteller. But I think you're the probably my favorite storyteller that I've ever heard on This American Life.
And, oh, wow.
And it goes back to, the sleepwalking story, the story of the car accident. I mean, just remarkable, remarkable stuff. Sleepwalk With Me, for our listeners who don't know, is the movie about 5 years ago that Mike did that you really ought to go watch. And it's true. I love how in the trailer and in the movie you say, people ask you, did this really happen? Because if you've got this kind of a disorder, it's really hard for people to believe that this can happen, right? I mean, that adults can do this.
I fell asleep and I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my room. And there's all these military personnel in the room with me. And I jump out of bed and I'm like, what's the plan? And they say, it's come to our attention, the missile coordinates are set specifically on you. And I thought, that's very bad. Because, I don't have a plan for that one. So I decided to jump out the window. In my dream. And... as it turns out, in my life. And there are two important details. One, I was on the second floor of La Quinta Inn, and two, the window was closed. So I jumped through a window like the Hulk. And I say that because that's how I described it at the emergency room. In Walla Walla, Washington, I was like, the Hulk, he just kind of jumps through stuff. So I jumped through the window and I scream, ah! And what was remarkable is that people of this disorder are capable of doing things they couldn't do in their everyday life. It's like blacking out drinking, where you don't feel any pain or inhibition. I jumped through a second-story window, and I landed on the front lawn of the hotel. I took a spill. I got back up, and I kept running.
It's very strange. I mean, I make the joke in the movie and in the show where I tell people, when I tell them the story, they'll say, was that true? And I'll say, yeah. And they'll say, was it? And I don't know what else to do. I mean, I could say it louder, like, yeah. They'd be like, it's probably true. He said it louder. But it really is so strange that to this day, people's number one question is, do you really sleepwalk? And it's like, I don't know what to tell. I mean, I have a disorder. There is no, it's called REM behavior disorder. There's no cure. I mean, I in the movie, I explain that I sleep, when I go to bed at night, I sleep in a sleeping bag up to my neck and I wear mittens. So I can't open the sleeping bag, but there's a new modification, which is my sleeping self has been able to figure out how to get out of the sleeping bag. So recently I worked with like a theater designer, like a props designer from Broadway, to make a sheet that has holes carved out for my head. And it's a fitted sheet that ties into the bed so that I can't. So I essentially tuck my body into my bed when I go to bed. So when I come to Rochester, for example, I'll go to the hotel and I will put on this fitted sheet, which, by the way, and I have to explain to housekeeping. I have to say, like, hey, this is my own sheet. It's not that I'm offended by your sheet. Isn't some odd sort of sex toy accessory. This is because I have a sleep disorder. And it's funny because I've gotten to know the housekeeping pretty well at hotels across the country.
Oh, I imagine you have to. Yeah, I mean, I did an overnight sleep study after I had a couple nights where I dove down a flight of stairs and landed at the bottom. And then the next night I got out the door in a dead sprint and only woke up when my feet started bleeding a couple of blocks later at about 3 a.m. And so,
oh God.
But the problem was I did the overnight study and nothing happened. And I'm going, no, you don't understand. It's, you know,
no, I know
your sleep center is too comfortable. It needs to be like a dungeon. And then I will probably do my stuff. But, yeah, the same thing.
No, it's that phenomenon where you have a croup cough and then you go to the doctor
right.
and you can't get yourself to cough.
Yeah, they put me on Klonopin and all that stuff, and it's just, it hasn't really changed anything. But I maybe will try.
Did it not work, Klonopin?
Not really. It made me really sluggish in the mornings, but no.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
I
will recommend a book that I have nothing to do with, but it's a wonderful sleep hygiene book called The Promise of Sleep by Dr. William C. Dement, which sounds like a joke name, but it's not. He's one of the forefathers of sleep medicine from Stanford. The Promise of Sleep is a great book because it tells you a lot of sort of very basic things about sleep hygiene. A few hours before bed, turn off your phone, don't watch the news, don't be on the internet. All these things that seem obvious, but actually all of us need to be reminded of.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the advice on that. I will definitely check that out.
It's a good one.
And listeners, if you're just joining us, Mike Birbiglia and I are opening up about our strangest problems. Mike is coming with his Working It Out tour July 14th and 15th at Comedy at the Carlson. And Mike, you wrote about this tour that you've never been more excited about stand-up in your whole career, which is a great way to promote. I mean, but you seem very sincere. Mm-hmm. that this is exciting, but it's also raw, that you understand it may or may not work. So what's the goal with this tour?
Well, it's funny because the Rochester show is going to be, in the fall, I go out to theaters. Like a week later, I go to Montreal to a theater. I go to the Berkeley Rep in California for a month. And then I go to 25 cities, you know, the Chicago theater, all these big theaters. But the Working It Out tour, this is the Rochester date, the final date where I'm really like trying a whole bunch of new material. But the truth is, the Rochester shows will be the best shows on the Working It Out tour because it's going to be the closest to done. But I would tell you, it's funny, I'm reluctant to tell people what it's sort of quote-unquote about because I hate it when people tell me, I don't even like to watch trailers of movies. I don't like when people tell me what happens in movies. Like, it's killing me right now that I haven't seen Baby Driver.
Right.
Because it's everyone's tweeting about it all the time, and I haven't seen it yet, and I know I love Edgar Wright, so it's driving me crazy. Anyway, I'll say this. If you're not familiar with what I do, you could watch My Girlfriend's Boyfriend or Thank God for Jokes on Netflix. You could watch my movies on Netflix, Don't Think Twice or Sleepwalk With Me. If you like those, I think you'll love this. If you don't like those, I am not for you.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's fair enough.
But that being said, if you like those, then I guarantee you like this show. It's a blast.
Listener,
this show's a blast.
Listeners will know that we don't generally just sort of have, we don't generally do interviews with people who are just entertainers for no good reason, but Mike Birbiglia has long been on my list of must interviews because I think your comedy, I think of sort of the modern pantheon of comedy. There's Louis C.K. and there's nobody like Louis C.K. There's Gaffigan. There's Gaffigan. There's nobody like Gaffigan. And there's you. And I don't think there's anybody like you. And I say that because there is such, and we're going to get like real full house here, but there is such meaning and value in what you do and the way you do it. Whether it's your movies, I thought Don't Think Twice was borderline profound, and I'm not trying to gush too much here. We'll talk about that in a second.
Oh, dang.
But even Sleepwalk With Me, the themes there are, it's not just about telling jokes. And I guess I just want to ask you about your process when it comes to the storytelling that you do as that becomes your comedy, and whether you are sort of setting out to, you know, to make us think, to make us feel beyond just laugh, Mike.
Well, I think what happened was, and thank you for all those compliments. It's undeserved, but I appreciate it. When I was in college, I was studying screenwriting and playwriting. And I really fell in love with like the films of like Woody Allen and Cameron Crowe and all these people where who would make films that James L. Brooks that make, you know, actually a great example of like Terms of Endearment or Broadcast News, films where I would be laughing, and then at a certain point, it would just punch me in the gut. Even a film like Jerry Maguire or Almost Famous or something where, like, where you, the emotion sneaks up on you. And so that was, at a certain point, I was, you know, I was doing stand-up comedy at the same time. I was studying dramatic writing. And I thought, well, that would be a great, that's a great goal in life, is to make live comedy shows that, that have a dose of both of those things. And so I would say that my mission statement when I write these shows and movies is to entertain people and make people laugh. And if they're, if they experience an emotion from it, I think that, that that's even better.
When it comes to Don't Think Twice, I think there are universal themes there. I mean, just about anybody listening to the sound of our voices today will be able to identify a moment in their life where somebody in a friend's group starts to break out. You know, maybe they start making a lot more money or they're much more successful. And it's especially tough if there is a group of friends who are all trying to break through in the same way and one does. Because what you hope is, you hope we're never going to change. You know, that we're always going to be tight. It's not going to impact us if one of us makes it and the others don't. But those dynamics get very, very difficult. And there's a concept in Don't Think Twice about the well. It's this idea of, well, what's wrong with being in the well? You know, why do I want to get out and explore if I'm comfortable in the well? Whereas other people say, I don't want to live my whole life in the well. I want to get out and see the world. I kind of think you can do, I kind of think, by the way, you can do both. I don't necessarily think it's either or, but I want to know for you and your group of friends, because you have busted out. You know, have you had that dynamic in your life, and how do you think you handled it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've, you know, there's six members of this fake improv group in Don't Think Twice, the commune. And, you know, my character, Miles, is sort of the bitter character who doesn't achieve the success he wants. And then Keegan-Michael Key's character is sort of a more successful character. And then Gillian Jacobs's character is struggling with it, I would say, between being in between those two or a third option of being a real idealist. I feel like there's parts of me in all three of those characters. I feel like I've felt bitter about other people's success before. I feel like I've felt some success that I feel lucky to have. And then I, you know, I felt alienated from that sometimes. You know, that can be a lonesome thing. And then I've felt sort of an ambivalence about the whole thing. So I don't know. I think, I mean, that's always, like you're saying, it's always the case with groups. Whether it's your coworkers or whether it's your soccer team in high school or whatever it is, where at a certain point it's every man or woman for themselves, and there's, it's just a hard reality. That's actually why Ira Glass sort of signed on to the film, to produce the film, is that he, when we were, I was in the writing process, I was writing drafts of it, and there was sort of a piece of that idea in it, and he said, I think that that's what the movie's about, and you really have to hit that point hard. And so I rewrote it with that in mind, which is, Ira's whole thing was, there's all these movies about success and there's no movies about failure. And he was like, let's make that movie. Like, let's make a movie about what happens when the struggling artist continues to struggle and doesn't, you know, achieve some kind of mass success. And so that was sort of what we set out to do. And yeah, it's an emotional thing watching the movie for me, because I feel like it's, you know, it's in some ways, you know, once you make a movie, it's sort of separate from you. It's its own thing. It's in the universe, and people have their own experience with it.
I thought your character, Miles, is a great example of how dynamic those characters were, because at various points throughout the movie, I found myself going, wait a second, I don't like this person, or I don't like what they're doing. You know, and Miles especially, I'm going, you know, come on. But then it made me self-reflect and say, boy, I bet you there have been moments in my life where I have been bitter at the success of friends, and I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the person who's, you know, sort of cursing others because blowing out their candle to make mine shine brighter. And you really made me sort of think about that. I just thought it was a beautiful film, man. I thought it was just outstanding. I love the work you do. I'm going to end with a question that is not meant to be political. You occasionally tweet about what seemed to be politics, but sometimes you couch it in saying, look, this is not even meant to be political. This is like human decency. How are we here? Has the current political climate made your job at all harder, or do you stay out of politics? You know, what are you encountering, especially on the road, with the reaction of people about that?
Well, it's funny because it's like, it's an odd, I don't really talk much about politics in this show. It's a very personal show, and I would say I allude to the present world situation a few times. In some ways, we're living in times where by not talking about politics, you are talking about politics, because it's so, we're so immersed in it all the time with the 24-hour news cycle that we're surrounded by in every airport and restaurant and bar. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like everything has been said about this presidency. My favorite line that I've seen tweeted was the comedian Bo Burnham, who people should check out if they're not familiar with him. He wrote, "If you don't want me to tweet about politics, then don't elect a joke."
Oh, that's good. I'm not endorsing, as the host of this program, I'm not endorsing the content. I'm just saying that's a clever
it's a clever
construction.
No, it's a nice, clever use of words.
That's
it,
right.
It really is.
Yeah, well.
But it is, it's an odd time for comedy, because it's just such an unprecedented period. And also there's this question of what's true and what's fake. And actually, jokes depend on truth. They depend on truth is the setup for punchlines. And if there is no truth, then what is the punchline?
Well, Mike, once again, giving us plenty to think about. And listeners, if you're just kind of getting into the Birbiglia sphere, the Netflix show is Thank God for Jokes. Go watch the film Sleepwalk with Me and Don't Think Twice. And Mike is coming for Comedy at the Carlson. It's a relatively new club off Blossom. And that's July 14th and 15th. Tickets on sale. We'll get you a link to those. Mike, it's my honor to have you. Good travels. We'll see you in Rochester. And thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
Coming up in our second hour, Votilla is coming. It is a week-long commemoration and celebration of the 100th anniversary of woman suffrage in New York State. We'll preview the events that are happening on the Erie Canal, the stops of Votilla, and some of the history behind it. Votilla, women's suffrage, next hour on Connections. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Loved that conversation with Mike Birbiglia, and now joined in studio by three people on the local comedy scene. Want to say hello to Yolanda Smiles.
Hi.
Who is the host of Tickle Me Tuesdays. She's a stand-up comedian. She's the CEO and co-founder of the Rock Awards. Nice to see you in studio.
Yes. How are you doing today?
Very good. Nice to have you. Andrea Holland is here. She's a public speaking coach, cast member of Estrofest Comedy Troupe.
That's right.
One of the, I mean, everybody here is one of the funniest people I know. It's nice to
no,
see you.
No, you are, Evan.
No. It's nice to see you. John Forrest Thompson is here. He's an educator, creative consultant. He's an improviser and member of the sketch comedy troupe Thank You Kiss. And you even have a new project as well. What's going on now?
Opening soon, August. We have the Focus Theater, which will be at Wedge Point in the South Wedge. So it's a small theater dedicated to improv and sketch comedy, also a training center. So
awesome! Yeah.
That is very exciting. Well, I kind of want to start where Birbiglia left off, and then there's a few themes I want to hit with our guests. I'll start with you, Andrea. He said that the truth is the setup for punchlines, and you got to have some kind of truth if you want to have punchlines. And we're in sort of a weird point, but whether it's Estrofest or wherever else you're playing your comedic
trade, humor.
Do you agree with writers like Owen Alexson, Mike Birbiglia, who say, right now, my comedy is going to be on life. I can't deal with politics. It's sort of beyond right now.
I do agree with that. And I think that there is truth in all comedy because, in my perspective, life is comedy. And as writers and performers, it's, of course, natural to pull from your real experiences. And a lot of times people will say, well, you know, the punchline hurts or it's painful to hear. Sometimes the punchline is that we laugh at the fact that we laugh at certain things. Mm. So, you know, for Estrofest, the comedy troupe I belong to, and in many ways, I find comedy in the fact that we laugh at certain things, even though they make us incredibly uncomfortable. So There is truth to comedy, I would always say.
On that note, I had a couple of Birbiglia's clips, and those were some of my favorite clips. But if you actually listen to the entire pieces there, either from This American Life or if you see the movies that those clips became, Don't Think Twice and Sleepwalk With Me, there's some moments where you laugh and you go, ooh, yeah. Ow, that hurts. wow, and that might be me, and that's, oh, man, that kind of hurts. So
it's true, but I think that's the beauty of comedy. Everybody thinks it's just chuckles galore, and you're supposed to roll with laughter, but I think good, smart comedy takes you on an emotional journey to the degree where you have laughs, and then you have thoughtful moments, and then you have even bigger laughs, and then there's the fall, and then, you know, it's just well-written comedy does that.
And then, of course, Yolanda, there are plenty of comedians who say right now, this is the time where we must joke about politics. We must joke about the world. Where do you come down when you put your material together?
Well, I'm with, like, basically life. Things that life experience that I have experienced. I'm not a big politic person, and I don't talk about it as much in my comedy because it can get very sensitive. You have your good and your bad with it. I might scrape it a little bit, but I don't make it a full topic. Or, you know, I have a joke where I talk about our president hair and how it's a comb over and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't go too far into what I really think because the crowd can get sensitive, and I just want to be able to cater to the entire audience without making them feel too uncomfortable.
John, I can recall the last time I saw a thank you kiss, I don't think the word Trump was mentioned. I don't know if that was by design. Is that by design right now?
It is, somewhat. We don't take anything off the table, but we kind of made an effort to do a no Trump show last time around, and we're doing that again with this show. And I think our thought behind it is that it's one of those things that just isn't funny right now. It certainly can be. I mean, it's
it can, hair but and, it's like
but yeah, it's just such a sensitive thing that I think it takes people to a place where you want to connect with people, and I think that's the big thing, and that's why truth is so important in improv. The Bible written by Sharna Halpern and Del Close is Truth in Comedy is the title. And from our training in improv, we're taught don't ever make jokes. You know, go out there and support one another and create scenes and create real scenes. And then we're trained to find the funny things within that reality. And when you look at the current landscape, when it comes down to it, there really isn't a whole lot of funny out there.
Sad, really.
Well, I think people are scared. I think people are nervous. And I think people are that way on both sides. It's certainly volatile. And really, comedy is just that. What you do is people know the setup, right? We're so familiar with sitcoms. And it's that left turn and that punchline that kind of smacks you in the face that's the funny. So really what you're doing is you're playing on people's frontal lobes, right? Our logic. We know it's going this way. We know that the joke is going this way. And it's that left turn that taps into the lizard brain, right? The survival brain that really, that's that uncomfortable laugh, right?
Right.
In the day, a huge tiger goes by a group of hunters, like in Africa, thousands of years ago or whatever. And they all laugh when they all live, right? Because it's this nervous laughter. And I think, that's a lot what comedy is. And I think the political landscape right now, it's just people just aren't having that sigh of relief type laughter right now.
Well, let me just follow that with a couple of things, because interesting that John says your training, and what John is describing for training for sketch comedy for improv, is not to try to be funny. Often you have people who kind of go into those classes think, well, I'm going to be funny tonight, or I'm the funny person. And you're looking for maybe the humor in a scene, but it's not necessarily an overt, now go be funny. And you also, I think in my mind, I go back to stand-up comedy, and I think, well, there's different approaches here. Are you going to just try to be funny and tell jokes, joke, 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 Stephen Wright, Mitch Hedberg. You know, no storytelling at all, just a series of observations and jokes. Or are you going to tell stories? And what I like about Birbiglia is, you know, he's telling a story of something that happened to him. He dove out a second story window that actually happened, or he got T-boned by a drunk driver, and then he was told that you have to pay a $12,000 bill because you're at fault because the police officer wrote the accident report incorrectly, and he shows the report on stage. That's storytelling that's very different than the Wright-Hedberg model. What do you prefer?
I prefer, you know, Birbiglia's point of view by far, just because it draws people in because they either relate to it or they connect to it in some way. Mm-hmm. And then when he heightens it, right, then it's people saying like, oh, thank God that isn't me. Right? So they're putting themselves in their shoes like, oh, yeah, I've been there. But then when you're like, oh, I would not want to pay that 12th, ha, 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 you know, that's funny and it's ridiculous, but thank goodness that wasn't me. That we're laughing at our own mortality, I guess.
Yolanda, you prefer sort of joke-telling, storytelling? You know, what's the approach here?
Well, my approach is pretty much, I'm not a big storyteller. I'm more of a one-liner. I'm now getting into doing more stories because of my son. My son is 4 years old, and Wesley is very entertaining.
Yeah, you got some stories about him.
I have a lot of stories about him. So I do a segment now because I'm trying to get more into being able to do cruises and things like that. So I do more of my parenting side of my classic adult humor that everyone knows me for. I pretty much go in and I talk about the stories of being a mom to this kid who has all this big imagination. He talks about the Incredible Hulk in his head, and the teacher's calling me saying he has the Incredible Hulk in his head. That's what he's telling me. And I said, Wesley, you don't have the Incredible Hulk in your head. He was like, well, he felt like he wanted to throw chairs, so that's what we did. And we threw a few at the students and the teacher. So then it was like, oh, this is a behavior thing. This is not. But in his head, Incredible Hulk was there. So that's an issue. But at the same time, I look at this kid who's very inspirational. And so my thing is, I do one-liners, but my stories, I try to keep them short because sometimes the audience attention span can't go as long. And when you're doing storytelling, you have to make sure within every 15 to 20 seconds, you got to have a punch just to keep them going. If it's not an interesting story, because then it becomes a seminar.
They definitely don't sign up for seminars. No,
yeah.
I'm with you on that.
Right.
I'm with you on that. Andrea Holland, again, when you're writing and creating for a sketch comedy group, that may be different than doing stand-up comedy. But are you interested in storytelling? Are you interested in just sort of a zing laugh? You know, what's the approach?
Well, with sketch comedy, we're looking at a particular scene, a small scene within a larger context. And so the sketch may be a few minutes long, and you are sort of telling a story, but it's not direct storytelling, as if in I was in front of an audience and telling them a funny story about a situation that happened. Personally, I do a lot of presenting for work. I'm a public speaking coach, so I do speak to a lot of audiences. And comedy and humor is a natural part of what I do. Because I grew up in a storytelling family, so John and Lucy Holland.
The best. The best.
They really are. You know, we grew up telling stories and having good laughs about that. So as a result, it's sort of a natural sort of skill set for me. But I really love storytelling as an effective way of getting a point across, having a good laugh, and bringing the audience on the emotional journey that they're so desperately wanting to have when they come and sit in front of you and say, please make me laugh.
Exactly.
I think comedy is that important nowadays, especially in the landscape of what we have going on. If I can't laugh, what else am I doing?
Exactly.
So please tell me a story, make me laugh.
I know you're on a tighter schedule, so let me have one more question for you.
Sure.
As a public speaking coach, I bet you there's a lot of people who want to open with a joke.
Oh God, please
help me. And I don't mind it if you are funny. And I think everybody can think of somebody who is, they think this is the best storyteller I know.
Yep.
Maybe it's your dad, maybe it's a friend, maybe you think you're a good storyteller, or this person is just naturally funny.
Mm-hmm.
This is the best public speaker I know. Maybe you've seen somebody who speak comes to work, but how many times, either through work or something, you have to sit through this presentation?
Oh God.
and I just flew in from Denver, and boy, are my arms tired, or whatever it is. It's some variation of that.
I was at an event actually last summer, and I was running sort of a session, a working session, and there was a fellow who got up to speak, and of course, right at the very start of it, he said, "I got a joke that I'm dying to tell you guys."
Oh, no.
And
don't set it up like that. What are you doing?
I mean, everybody, you could hear the audience going, "Oh, God." It was this like really awkward sigh, and he proceeded anyhow, and it was a terrible joke. It went over like a lead balloon. It was so bad, and it ruined the rest of his presentation. Whatever else he had to say was completely irrelevant. But I do sit through that a lot, and I always, you know, just like you said, Evan, don't set it up that way. If you're going to be funny, just let the comedy flow naturally. Let people find the funny in you. And I think as a performer or a speaker, it's so important to make sure your comedy is not about you. It's, yes, it's in the context of your experience, but it's about the audience and how they relate. So if telling the joke, you know, "Oh, I just flew in from Denver and my arms are tired," if they're not going to connect with that, don't waste your time.
But Andrew, I sort of blame the audience, and I've made a vow. I can't give you a courtesy laugh anymore, because that's a lie to you. And the next audience you go to might think that you're funny.
I would agree.
I can't give you bad information.
No, I agree with you. And I don't ever want an audience to laugh just because they're like, "Oh God, get her off the stage. It's tragic."
That's the worst. Right?
No, I want to work for your laugh. Yeah. I do.
I
want to work for your laugh.
You have to assume the audience is one step ahead of you.
Right.
Whether you're writing, you have to assume that they're one step ahead of you. And that's what I think makes stand-up such a harder discipline.
It is.
You know, and like you said, if you have a guy giving a presentation and he's going to go out there and have one joke, stand-up's like a salesperson, right?
What stand-up is, it's harder because at the end of the day, there's no script. There's nothing to follow. It's the emotion of the room. It's the audience. It's the you and the microphone. It's not a hype man. It's not nothing that's going to pop out of a box.
But even more than that, the expectation from the audience is, we're coming to a comedy show. This one person is going to make me laugh. They said they're going to make me laugh. So they're almost in their brains crossing their arms like,
waiting.
Go. Where is it? Let's go.
And what I've learned doing too, the different rooms, because it's a difference in vibes. Most black rooms, I will just say black rooms, African American, I don't want to, whatever, typical, whatever, I don't know, whatever. those rooms are harder to, because they are very, because they think they're funny. So it's like a harder room to pull a laugh out of sometimes. And then I would say my Caucasian or white rooms, you guys are more relaxed and just like, hey, I want to have a good time. I'm here. I had a beer. I really don't care. Still need to make me laugh. It's more polite, but it's more of a comfort.
That's
and more
interesting.
Easier.
Yeah. Your black audiences are harder.
Very hard. Oh, my God. Very, very hard. Like, to the point where it's like, it's almost intimidating. And that's why you don't see a lot of white comics do that circuit of room, because it is, they don't understand. First of all, they're scared they might offend, because it's a very sensitive crowd. Anything you say and it doesn't connect with them, oh, they're racist. And it's not true. It's comedy. You need to be, and a lot of people are not open-minded. So that's the difference with stand-up sometimes in those different rooms. But stand-up is definitely a harder bull. And I won't say sketch or improv is not hard, but you definitely can have something to fall on improv, because you can improv something to make them laugh.
we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to ask, because Andrew's got to go. So the last thing I wanted to ask you is, when you have clients who say, "Can you make me funny?" Because some people are just sort of naturally more gifted than others.
Sure.
Can you train someone to be a funny writer, a funny performer, to be funny?
I think it can be learned. I do. I think it's more of looking at perspective. So what is the perspective you have on a daily basis, where you allow comedy and humor to be part of your view? Because oftentimes people say, "Well, I just want to be funny," and they'll go like read joke books, or, you know, they try to emulate, you know, Steve Carell or some sort of actor that they've seen be funny, and they try to mimic the body language and the whatnot. And it's really about, if you can wake up every day, and I really do believe this, if you can wake up every day and say, "I was walking in my sleep last night. That is the most ridiculous thing ever. Oh my God, I have to tell this funny experience to someone else," and you can relay that, that is where you cultivate a funny bone or you cultivate comedy. But it's really innate. It's in the ability of the person to see something from a funny perspective.
Painting that picture.
Yeah, and it can be learned. It can. Yeah.
Well, step one, I want to just say thank you for step one, which is teaching your client, before we get you to learn how to actually be funny, don't tell the joke that you thought you wanted to tell at the opening of your next present.
Resist
just don't
urge.
Do it. Do not do it. And especially don't set up by saying, well, I've got this joke I want to tell.
Oh, God.
Is everybody ready for a laugh?
Right.
Everybody's going, oh,
no,
please don't do
no.
it. Don't do it. Don't do it. You know, you set the bar so high. So,
yeah.
Well, you got to roll?
I do have to roll in a moment, yes.
Okay,
I apologize.
I got some clients. Told you got clients to go meet with. So thank you. It's always nice to see you.
Yes.
Andrea Holland is a public speaking coach, cast member of Estrofest Comedy Troupe. When's next Estrofest performing?
We are performing for Fringe Festival.
Oh, wow.
Five shows.
What is this Fringe? I've not heard of it.
I was kidding. Like, Evan?
Okay.
No. Fringe Festival will be at Jiva Theaters. Stage, and we have five performances for Fringe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, wow. Very excited. It's going to be, you know, our usual uncanniness.
Yeah.
Cinderella, droids, you name it. It's all in there.
Is your character Johnny coming back?
Maybe. Perhaps. Okay. I won't reveal that yet.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's nice to see you. We're talking to Andrea Holland, who's got a split. Yolanda Smiles is a stand-up comedian, CEO, and co-founder of the Rock Awards. She's also the host of
Tickle Me Tuesday.
Which is what?
Tickle Me Tuesday is on 109WXIR.com, over there, worldwide.com. And we do a radio show where we talk about different topics, hot topics that's going on in the media. We have comedy on the show. We invite community leaders to come in and, you know, plug their events that are going on. We did health awareness yesterday where we have a people come in and talk about health awareness and things in that nature. So it's a real fun show. It's high energy, but it's also educating the community about the different things that are going on. So it's a group of us. It's actually Charlotta Broom, LaCarla, Juicy LaCarla, excuse me. That's her comedy name, excuse me. I want to get everybody right. And our DJ Cuts and Comedy Ledge, he's involved with us as well. So it's a good group of people, and we have a good time every Tuesday from 7 to 8 on that station, 100.9 FM radio.
And John Forrest Thompson, educator, yeah, creative consultant, improviser, and member of the sketch comedy troupe Thank You Kiss. Thank You Kiss is going to be at Fringe as well, September 22nd at 9 o'clock and September 23rd at 3 o'clock at Blackfriars. I had that information because I was told you would definitely not have it. Is that true?
I believe you when you say that I will be at those places.
Yeah. There's no way you would have known, is there?
I actually knew those dates because Megan told me them yesterday. So.
Okay. I want to ask both of you, when you're writing material, what comes first, you or the audience? And that was sort of a theme that we talked about with Mike Birbiglia earlier, which is, you know, he's relating his experience, and as John sort of keyed in on, we may not be sleepwalkers. I mean, I am. I'm one of the few people in Birbiglia's audience who goes, oh, you dove out a window? Well, I dove down a stairwell. So, but most of his audience can't, but they can at least relate to certain elements of that. And then maybe, as John said, you take it to the next level. But Birbiglia is writing material that at least I think tries to bring in people with common experiences and then relate something that I think ends up being pretty thought-provoking and at times pretty thoughtful stuff from Mike. John, when I'll start with you in this. When you're writing, you know, do you use a joke that you think is funny, thought-provoking, even though you might, you know, might not go over well with an audience, you know, or does it have to be audience first? You know, what's the mindset?
Yeah, I think what I do is I tap into it. If I think it's funny, or if, you know, oh, what if I put this in this situation, if that's funny, or, you know, this happened to me. And then I try to finesse it through the writing process. You know, we're talking about sketch writing or, you know, or stand-up, so that I do think of the audience, and I keep that in mind. They're going to be a step ahead of me. So if I thought this was funny, how do I take it to another level? Like, what I liked what Mike did with that story about the T-bone is that, you know, he built up that pressure and that tension, and then he said, it's like when you drop a baby, right?
It's like,
and it's like, no one's dropped a baby, but we all instantly thought of like that, and dropping a baby's never funny. Yeah.
No.
But it was funny in that instance because it gave us the release to do that. And we thought, oh, that would be funny, you know. So it's really kind of like pitching. It's you got a fastball, curveball, throw it in there. And every, like you said, every 20 seconds, you got to kind of keep the audience on their toes.
Yes.
But I definitely start with personal things that I think are funny or that I think people can relate to. And you just get that honesty and that vulnerability. I think the vulnerability is what people appreciate and that brings that audience in. Then once you get them in there, then comes that comedy skill of how do I manipulate it to make it that much funnier.
Exactly.
And then so Yolanda.
Yes.
You talked about how certain rooms can be tougher. And
yes.
There are times where, you know, it's almost combative or you feel like you got
to
earn it and maybe you're not getting the laughs. I want to know from both of you, you've written something that you really believe in. First of all, you think it's funny. Second of all, you think it has some meaning to it.
Right.
But it is not getting the laugh that you expected. How many more times and how many more shows are you going to keep hammering away at this because you believe in it before you say, I don't know why this doesn't land, but we're going to pull this? Or are there certain ones where you say, I don't care if you're not going to laugh. I want to send this message anyway.
Well, I think that it goes back to when you're on stage as a stand-up comedian and you're reading your audience. There's a lot of jokes that I would do again in the black rooms that I won't do in the white rooms because it's not relatable. And sometimes I'll even try it out to see if it's a connection. But when I write, I pretty much write on personal experience and try to find out where my audience brain can go. Where can I take my audience brain with this one? Because everyone, I just wrote a joke the other day. I say, hey, I've just been released. I'm just graduated from DTA. And everyone's like, what is DTA? Drunk Text Anonymous. Like, everyone knows that they have sent a drunk text out and is embarrassed about the drunk text. But it was an experience that I had went through. And now where do I take this? Now do I go, I sit in AA meetings and I watch what the people are doing in the AA meeting. So now I can connect with taking it broader and things like that. So it's also educating yourself with the topic. So that everyone can connect no matter what room you're doing. And that's the thing, the uniqueness with me is I'm not scared to do any room. And I can relate to all audience because my topics are something that the audience all have experienced, no matter what race, color, religion you are. So that's what makes me a unique comic when I get on stage and people call me all over to do comedy. So I love it.
Okay, John, have you ever had something that did not land and you go, don't know why this didn't land? Or maybe it lands one night and then the next night, not as much.
Yeah, those are the biggest mysteries. You'll write a sketch or a joke and one night people love it and the next night people won't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot goes into that. Like you said, it's point of view of the audience. It might be the flow of your set and your show and maybe how that it fits in that night. Maybe, you know, something. I never try to force something down people's throats, though. I think if it doesn't work enough times, you pull it or you try to finesse it and figure out why isn't that funny.
Even if it's something where you go, not only do I think it's funny, but I feel really good about. I mean, like there's a message here. There's some because some of the stuff that you guys do is just funny. Some of the stuff you do, I go, wow, that really made me think about something. And are you more likely to keep pushing for it if it's one of those sketches or jokes that has meaning to it?
If it has meaning to it and it doesn't hit, to me that says people aren't relating to it. Mm. If it's ridiculous and it's self-gratuitous, we definitely have a couple of those.
Right.
We do this thing like riding the bus with friends where we just sing about riding on the bus and maybe three people in the audience will think it's funny. But we have so much fun doing it and make each other laugh and kind of looking at each other like how stupid are we on stage right now?
And they're loving it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, some things, every once in a while, gratuitous. But I would say if it's not working, most often I'll either try to adjust it or drop it, especially if it's something with, like, kind of meaning and oomph.
Yeah.
You know, some social commentary or...
For example, with my four-year-old, he has, I won't say a disability, but his attention span is very short. To the point where he doesn't, at this age, he should know his ABCs, the order, but he doesn't get it. He'll start it off and then he'd be like, this is so boring. And at first I didn't understand it, but then he would use very big words like, you know, the extraordinary and things like that. Oh, I had an extraordinary day. And I'd be like, come on, dude, you should be saying your ABCs if you're saying extraordinary. Like, get yourself together, okay? So, but with him, I was like, wow, okay, I get it. You know, and I would do that joke about, oh, he doesn't know his ABCs. And a lot of people get, I was like, he might be kind of like, we're going to get a check for him. So some people take that as Now I'm picking at children with disabilities. But then I switch it up. I say, my son says, forget the order. It doesn't make sense of the order of the alphabet. Is when you mix those letters up, it makes sense. So I said, wow, my son taught me something at four. So then I get that big laugh. But at a few rooms was not connecting with that because they thought I was making fun of my son's disability. And it wasn't what I was trying to get to. The bigger message was, yeah, the alphabet in order doesn't really make any sense.
But he's using five-syllable adjectives.
Thank you. Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yolanda, we're down to our last 40 seconds or so. So where can people see you next? Where you want
well, next right now we are doing every third Thursday at Clarissa Room, 293 Clarissa Street. There's a live band, jazz, jokes, and wine evening there. Every third Thursday, one is coming July 20th. They can see me there. That show starts at 8 p.m. And then August 27th, I will be at the One Art Gallery. And also, we have the Blessing in a Book Bag really quick. Anyone who's want to be interested in helping with the Blessing in a Book Bag, last year we did 500 children, supplied them with book bags and food. If anyone wants to be a part of that, they can contact me at, can I give the number?
Yeah, go ahead.
585-210-8841. That's 585-210-8841. If anyone want to get supplies or volunteer, the Blessing in a Book Bag is August 26th. We really need everyone's support with that.
Thank you, Yolanda and John Forrest Thompson with Thank You Kiss at Fringe, September 22nd at 9 o'clock, the 23rd at 3 at Blackfriars, among other things. Yeah. And
Focus Theater, come find us.
Yes.
It's called Focus Theater. Are you online? Theater.
We are on, we will, focustheater.us will be there by the end of the week.
Awesome.
Thank you, and our thanks to Mike Birbiglia as well.